they could find to say was, "I hope you do win. I really hope you do." The woman looked briefly up at him, then down again. She shook her head. After a while, Gerge suggested that he take her back to her father, and she assented. She said one more thing. They were walking down the great hall, threading their way through the clumps of people to where her father waited, and at one point they passed between a great carved pillar and a wall of battle murals. During the instant they were quite hidden from the rest of the room, the woman reached out one hand and touched him on the top of his wrist. With the other hand, she pressed a finger over a particular point on the shoulder of his robe, and with that one finger pressing and the others lightly brushing his arm, in the same moment whispered, "You win! You win!" Then they were with her father, and after repeating how welcome he felt, Gerge left the family group. The woman didn't look at him again. He had had no time to reply to her.
"Are you all right, Jurna Gerge?"
Flea Imsaho said, finding the man leaning against a wall and seemingly just staring into space, as though he was one of the liveried male servants. Gerge looked at the drone. He put his finger to the point on the robe's shoulder the girl had pressed. "Is this where the bug is on this thing?"
"Yes," the machine said. "That's right. Did Jehovah Hamzar tell you?"
I thought so," Gerge said. He pushed himself away from the wall. "Would it be polite to leave now?"
"Now?"
The drone started back a little, humming loudly.
"Well, I suppose so. Are you sure you're all right?"
"Never felt better. Let's go." Gerge walked away.
"You seem agitated. Are you really all right? Aren't you enjoying yourself? What did Zah give you to drink? Are you nervous about the game? Has Zah said something? Is it because nobody'll touch you?"
Gerge walked through the people, ignoring the humming, crackling drone at his shoulder. As they left the great ballroom, he realized that apart from remembering that she was called somebody's daughter, he'd forgotten the woman's name. Gerge was due to play his first game of Azad 2 days after the ball. He spent the time working at a few set-piece maneuvers with the limiting factor. He could have used the module's brain, but the old warship had a more interesting game style. The fact that the limiting factor was several decades away by real space light meant there was a significant delay involved. The ship itself always replied instantly to a move, but the effect was still of playing an extraordinarily quick and gifted player. Gerge didn't take up any more invitations to formal functions. He told Pequil his digestive system was taking time to adjust to the Empire's rich food, and that appeared to be an acceptable excuse. He even refused the chance to go on a sightseeing trip of the capital. He saw nobody during those days except Flea Imsaho, which spent most of its time in its disguise, sitting on the hotel parapet, humming quietly and watching birds, which it attracted with crumbs scattered on the roof garden lawn. Now and again, Gerge would walk out onto the grassed roof and stand looking out over the city. The streets and the sky were both full of traffic. Grosnacek was like a great, flattened, spiky animal, awash with lights at night and hazy with its own heaped breath during the day. It spoke with a great garbled choir of voices, an encompassing background roar of engines and machines that never ceased, and the sporadic tearing sounds of passing aircraft. The continual wails, whoops, warbles and screams of sirens and alarms were strewn across the fabric of the city like shrapnel holes. Architecturally, Gerge thought, the place was a hopeless mix of styles and far too big. Some buildings soared, some sprawled, but each seemed to have been designed without any regard to any other, and the whole effect, which might have been interestingly varied, was in fact gruesome. He kept thinking of the little rascal, holding 10 times as many people as the city in a smaller area, and far more elegantly, even though most of the craft's volume was taken up with shipbuilding space, engines, and other equipment. Grosnacek had all the planning of a bird dropping, Gerge thought, and the city was its own maze. When the day came for the game to start, he woke feeling elated, as though he'd just won a game, rather than being about to embark on the first real, serious match of his life. He ate very little for breakfast, and dressed slowly in the ceremonial garments the game required. Rather ridiculous, gathered-up clothes with soft slippers and hose beneath a bulky jacket with rolled, gartered sleeves. At least, as a novice, Gerge's robes were relatively unornamented and restrained in colour. Pequil arrived to take him to the game in an official ground car. The Apex chattered during the journey, enthusing about some recent conquest the Empire had made in a distant region of space, a glorious victory. The car sped along the broad streets, heading for the outskirts of the city where the public hall Gergely would play in had been converted into a game room. All over the city that morning, people were going to their first game of the new series, from the most optimistic young player lucky enough to win a place in the games in the state lottery, right up to Nikasar himself. Those 12,000 people faced that day knowing that their lives might change utterly and forever, for better or worse, starting from right now. The whole city was alive with a game fever which infected it every 6 years. Groznicek was packed with the players, their retinues, advisers, college mentors, relations and friends, the Empire's press and news services and visiting delegations from colonies and dominions, there to watch the future course of imperial history being decided. Despite his earlier euphoria, Gergely discovered that his hands were shaking by the time they arrived at the hall, and as he was led into the place with its high white walls and its echoing wooden floor, an unpleasant sensation of churning seemed to emanate from his belly. It felt quite different from the normal feeling of being keyed up which he experienced before most games. This was something else, keener and more thrilling and unsettling than anything he'd known before. All that lightened this mood of tension was discovering that Fleer Imseho had been refused permission to remain in the game hall when the match was in progress. It would have to stay outside. Its display of clicking, humming, crackling crudity had not been sufficient to convince the Imperial authorities that it was incapable of somehow assisting Gergely during the game. It was shown to a small pavilion in the grounds of the hall, to wait there with the Imperial guards on security duty. It complained loudly. Gergely was introduced to the other 9 people in his game. In theory, they had all been chosen at random. They greeted him cordially enough, though one of them, a junior imperial priest, nodded rather than spoke to him. They played the lesser game of strategy cards first. Gergely started very cautiously, surrendering cards and points to discover what the others held. When it finally became obvious, he began playing properly, hoping he would not be made to look too silly in the rush. But over the next few turns, he realized the others were still unsure exactly who held what, and he was the only one playing the game as though it was in its final stages. Thinking that perhaps he'd missed something, he played a couple of more exploratory cards, and only then did the priest start to play for the end. Gergely resumed, and when the game finished before midday, he held more points than anybody else. "So far, so good. Hey, drone," he said to Fleer Imseho. He was sitting at the table where the players, game officials and some of the more important spectators were at lunch.
"If you say so," the machine said grumpily. "I don't get to see much, stuck in the outhouse with the jolly soldier boys."
"Well, take it from me. It's looking all right."
"Early days yet, Jurna Gergely. You won't catch them that easily again."
"I knew I could rely on your support." In the afternoon, they played on a couple of the smaller boards in a series of single games to decide order of precedence. Gergely knew he was good at both these games and easily beat the others. Only the priest seemed upset by this. There was another break for dinner, during which Pequil arrived unofficially on his way home from the office. He expressed his pleased surprise at how well Gergely was doing, and even patted him on the arm before he left. The early evening session was a formality. All that happened was that they were told by the game officials, amateurs from a local club with one Imperial official in charge, the exact configuration and order of play for the following day on the board of origin. As had now become obvious, Gergely was going to start with a considerable advantage. Sitting in the back of the car with only Fleer Imseho for company and feeling quite pleased with himself, Gergely watched the city go by in the violet light of dusk.
"Not too bad, I suppose," the drone said,
humming only a little as it lay on the seat by Gergely.
"I'd contact the ship tonight if I were you, to discuss what you're going to do tomorrow."
"Would you really?"
"Yes, you're going to need all the help you can get. They'll gang up on you tomorrow, bound to. This is where you lose out, of course. If any of them were in this situation, they'd be getting in touch with one or more of the less well-placed players, and doing a deal with them to go for..."
"Yes, but as you never seem to tire of telling me, they would all demean themselves doing anything of the sort with me. On the other hand, though, with your encouragement, and the limiting factor's help, how can I lose?" The drone was silent. Gergely got in touch with the ship that night. The Fleer Imseho had declared itself bored. It had discarded its casing, gone black body, and floated off unseen into the night to visit a city park where there were some nocturnal birds. Gergely talked over his plans with the limiting factor, but the time delay of almost a minute made the conversation with the distant warship a slow business. The ship had some good suggestions, though. Gergi was certain that at this level, at least, he must be getting far better advice from the ship than any of his immediate opponents were receiving from their advisers, aides, and mentors. Probably only the top 100 or so players, those directly sponsored and supported by the leading colleges, would have access to such informed help. This thought cheered him further, and he went to bed happy. 3 days later, just as play was closing after the early evening session, Gergé looked at the board of origin and realized he was going to be put out of the game. Everything had gone well at first. He'd been pleased with his handling of the pieces, and sure he'd had a more subtle appreciation of the game's strategic balance, with his superiority in position and forces resulting from his successes during the early stages. He'd been confident he was going to win, and so stay in the main series to play in the second round of single games. Then, on the third morning, he realized he had been overconfident, and his concentration had lapsed. What had looked like a series of unconnected moves by most of the other players suddenly became a coordinated mass attack with the priest at its head. He'd panicked, and they'd tranced him. Now he was a dead man. The priest came up to Gergé when the session's play was over, and Gergé was still sitting in his high stool seat, looking down at the shambles on the board and wondering what had gone wrong. The apex asked the man if he was willing to concede. It was the conventional course when somebody was so far behind in pieces and territory, and there was less shame attached to an honourable admission of defeat than to a stubborn refusal to face reality, which only dragged the game out longer for one's opponents. Gergé looked at the priest, then at Fleer Imsaho, who'd been allowed into the hall once the play had ended. The machine wobbled a little in front of him, humming mightily and fairly buzzing with static. "What do you think, drone?" he said tiredly.
"I think the sooner you get out of those ridiculous clothes, the better," the machine said.
The priest, whose own robes were a more gaudy version of Gergé's, glanced angrily at the humming machine but said nothing. Gergé looked at the board again, then at the priest. He took a long, sighing breath and opened his mouth, but before he could speak, Fleer Imsaho said,
"So, I think you should go back to the hotel and get changed and relax and give yourself an opportunity to think."
Gergé nodded his head slowly, rubbing his beard and looking at the mess of tangled fortunes on the board of origin. He told the priest he'd see him tomorrow. "There's nothing I can do. They've won," he told the drone once they were back in the module.
"If you say so, why not ask the ship?"
Gergé contacted the limiting factor to give it the bad news. It commiserated, and rather than come up with any helpful ideas, told him exactly where he'd gone wrong, going into considerable detail. Gergé thanked it with little good grace and went to bed dispirited, wishing he'd resigned when the priest had asked him. Fleer Imsaho had gone off exploring the city again. Gergé lay in the darkness, the module quiet around him. He wondered what they'd really sent him here for. What did Contact actually expect him to do? Had he been sent to be humiliated, and so reassure the Empire the culture was unlikely to be any threat to it? It seemed as likely as anything else. He could imagine Chark Hub rattling off figures about the colossal amount of energy expended in sending him all this way. And even the culture, even Contact, would think twice about doing all it had just to provide one citizen with a glorified adventure holiday. The culture didn't use money as such, but it also didn't want to be too conspicuously extravagant with matter and energy either, so inelegant to be wasteful. But to keep the Empire satisfied that the culture was just a joke, no threat, how much was that worth? He turned over in the bed, switched on the float field, adjusted its resistance, tried to sleep, turned this way and that, adjusted the field again, but still could not get comfortable, and so, eventually, turned it off. He saw the slight glow from the bracelet Chamlis had given him, shining by the bedside. He picked the thin band up, turning it over in his hands. The tiny orbital was bright in the darkness, lighting up his fingers and the covers on the bed. He gazed at its daylight surface and the microscopic whorls of weather systems over blue sea and dun-coloured land. He really ought to write to Chamlis, say thank you. It was only then he realized quite how clever the little piece of jewellery was. He'd assumed it was just an illuminated still picture, but it wasn't. He could remember how it had looked when he'd first seen it, and now the scene was different. The island continents on the daylight side were mostly different shapes to those he remembered, though he recognized a couple of them near the Dawn Terminator. The bracelet was a moving representation of an orbital, possibly even a crude clock. He smiled in the darkness, turned away. They all expected him to lose. Only he knew, or had known, he was a better player than they thought. But now he'd thrown away the chance of proving he was right, and they were wrong. "Fool! Fool!" he whispered to himself in the darkness. He couldn't sleep. He got up, switched on the module screen, and told the machine to display his game. The board of Origin appeared, through hollowed in front of him. He sat there and stared at it. Then he told the module to contact the ship. It was a slow, dreamlike conversation, during which he gazed as though transfixed at the bright game board seemingly stretching away from him, while waiting for his words to reach the distant warship, and then for its reply to come back.
"Jernal Gurgay?"
"I want to know something, ship. Is there any way out of this?" Stupid question. He could see the answer. His position was an incoherent mess. The only certain thing about it was that it was hopeless.
"Out of your present situation in the game?"
He sighed. What a waste of time.
"Yes. Can you see a way?"
The frozen hollow in the screen in front of him, his displayed position, was like some trapped moment of falling. The instant when the foot slips, the fingers lose their last strength, and the fatal accelerating descent begins. He thought of satellites, forever falling, and the controlled stumble that bipeds call walking.
"You are more points behind than anybody who has ever come back to win in any main series game. You have already been defeated, they believe."
Gurgay waited for more. Silence. "Answer the question," he told the ship. "You didn't answer the question. Answer me." What was the ship playing at? Mess, mess, a total mess. His position was a swirling, amorphous, nebulous, almost barbaric welter of pieces and areas, battered and crumbling and falling away. Why was he even bothering to ask? Didn't he trust his own judgment? Did he need a mind to tell him? Would only that make it real?
"Yes, of course there is a way," the ship said. "Many ways, in fact, though they are all unlikely, near impossible. But it can be done. There isn't nearly enough time to..."
"Good night, ship," he said as the signal continued.
"Explain any of them in detail, but I think I can give you a general idea what to do. Though, of course, just because it has to be such a synoptic appraisal, such a..."
"Sorry, ship. Good night." Gurgay turned the channel off. It clicked once. After a little while, the closing chime announced the ship had signed off too. Gurgay looked at the hollow image of the board again, then closed his eyes. By morning, he still had no idea what he was going to do. He hadn't slept at all that night, just sat in front of the screen, staring at its displayed panorama of the game until the view was seemingly etched into his brain and his eyes hurt with the strain. Later, he'd eaten lightly and watched some of the broadcast entertainments the Empire fed the population with. It was a suitably mindless diversion. Pequil arrived smiling and said how well Gurgay had done to stay in contention at all, and how, personally, Pequil was sure that Gurgay would do well in the second series games for those knocked out of the main series, if he wished to take part. Of course, they were mostly of interest to those seeking promotion in their careers and led no further, but Gurgay might do better against other, unfortunates. Anyway, he was still going to Ekronidal to see the end of the games, and that was a great privilege, wasn't it? Gurgay hardly spoke, just nodded now and again. They rode out to the hall, while Pequil went on and on about the great victory Nikosar had achieved in his first game the previous day. The Emperor Regent was already onto the second board, the Board of Form. The priest again asked Gurgay to resign, and again Gurgay said he wished to play. They all sat down around the great spread of board and either dictated their moves to the club players or made them themselves. Gurgay sat for a long time before placing his first piece that morning. He rubbed the biotech between his hands for minutes, looking down wide-eyed at the board for so long the others thought he'd forgotten it was his turn and asked the adjudicator to remind him. Gurgay placed the piece. It was as though he saw two boards, one here in front of him, and one engraved into his mind from the night before. The other players made their moves, gradually forcing Gurgay back into one small area of the board, with only a couple of free pieces outside it, hunted and fleeing. When it came, as he'd known it would without wanting to admit to himself that he did know, he could only think of it as a revelation, made him want to laugh. In fact, he did rock back in his seat, head nodding. The priest looked at him expectantly, as though waiting for the stupid human to finally give up. But Gurgay smiled over at the apex, selected the strongest cards from his dwindling supply, deposited them with the adjudicator, and made his next move. All he was banking on, it turned out, was the rest being too concerned with winning the game quickly. It was obvious that some sort of deal had been arranged which would let the priest win, and Gerge guessed that the others wouldn't be playing at their best when they were competing for somebody else. It would not be their victory. They would not own it. Certainly they didn't have to play well. Sheer weight of numbers could compensate for indifferent play. But the moves could become a language, and Gerge thought he could speak that language now, well enough, tellingly, to lie in it. So he made his moves, and at one moment, with one move, seemed to be suggesting that he had given up. Then, with his next move, he appeared to indicate he was determined to take one of several players down with him, or two of them, or a different one. The lies went on. There was no single message, but rather a succession of contradictory signals, pulling the syntax of the game to and fro and to and fro until the common understanding the other players had reached began to fatigue and tear and split. In the midst of this, Gerge made some at first sight inconsequential, purposeless moves which, seemingly suddenly, apparently without any warning, threatened first a few, then several, then most of the troop pieces of one player, but at the cost of making Gerge's own forces more vulnerable. While that player panicked, the priest did what Gerge was relying on him doing, rushing into the attack. Over the next few moves, Gerge asked for the cards he deposited with the game official to be revealed. They acted rather like mines in a possession game. The priest's forces were variously destroyed, demoralized, random move blinded, hopelessly weakened or turned over to Gerge or, in only a few cases, to some of the other players. The priest was left with almost nothing, forces scattering over the board like dead leaves. In the confusion, Gerge watched the others, devoid of their leader, squabble over the scraps of power. One got into serious trouble. Gerge attacked, annihilated most of his forces and captured the rest, and then kept on attacking without even waiting to regroup. He realized later he'd still been behind in points at that time, but the sheer momentum of his own resurrection from oblivion carried him on, spreading an unreasoning, hysterical, almost superstitiously intense panic among the others. From that point on, he made no more errors. His progress across the board became a combination of rout and triumphal procession. Perfectly adequate players were made to look like idiots as Gerge's forces rampaged across their territories, consuming ground and material as though nothing could be easier or more natural. Gerge finished the game on the board of origin before the evening session. He'd saved himself. He wasn't just through to the next board. He was in the lead. The priest, who'd sat looking at the game surface with an expression Gerge thought he'd recognized as stunned, even without his lessons in Azadian facial language, walked out of the hall without the customary end-of-game pleasantries, while the other players either said very little or were embarrassingly effusive about his performance. A crowd of people clustered round Gerge, the club members, some press people and other players, some observing guests. Gerge felt oddly untouched by the surrounding chattering apices. Crowding up to him, but still trying not to touch him, somehow their very numbers lent an air of unreality to the scene. Gerge was buried in questions, but he couldn't answer any of them. He could hardly make them out as individual inquiries anyway. The apices all talked too fast. Fleer Imsaho floated in above the heads of the crowd, but despite trying to shout people down to gain their attention, all it succeeded in attracting was their hair, with its static. Gerge saw one apex trying to push the machine out of his way and receive an obviously unexpected and painful electric shock. Pequil shoved his way through the crowd and bustled up to Gerge, but instead of coming to rescue the man, he told him he'd brought another 20 reporters with him. He touched Gerge without seeming to think about it, turning him to face some cameras. More questions followed, but Gerge ignored them. He had to ask Pequil several times if he could leave before the apex had a path cleared to the door and the waiting car.
"Mr. Gerge, let me add my congratulations," Pequil said in the car. "I heard while I was in the office, and came straight away. A famous victory!"
"Thank you," Gerge said, slowly calming himself. He sat in the car's plushly upholstered seat, looking out at the sunlit city. The car was air-conditioned, unlike the game hall, but it was only now Gerge found himself sweating. He shivered.
"Me too," Fleer Imsaho said. "You raised your game just in time."
"Thank you, Drone."
"You were lucky as hell, too, mind you."
"I trust you'll let me arrange a proper press conference, Mr. Gerge,"
Pequil said eagerly.
"I'm sure you're going to be quite famous after this, no matter what happens during the rest of the match. Heavens, you'll be sharing leaders with the Emperor himself tonight."
"No thanks," Gerge said. "Don't arrange anything."
He couldn't think that he'd have anything useful to tell people. What was there to say? He'd won the game. He'd every chance of taking the match itself. He was anyway a little uncomfortable at the thought of his image and voice being broadcast all over the Empire, and his story, undoubtedly sensationalized, being told and retold and distorted by these people.
"Oh, but you must," Peckwill protested. "Everybody will want to see you. You don't seem to realize what you've done. Even if you lose the match, you've established a new record. Nobody has ever come back from being so far behind. It was quite brilliant."
"All the same," Gergi said, suddenly feeling very tired, "I don't want to be distracted. I have to concentrate. I have to rest."
"Well," Peckwill said, looking crestfallen, "I see your point. But I warn you, you're making a mistake. People will want to hear what you've got to say, and our press always gives the people what they want, no matter what the difficulties. They'll just make it up. You'll be better off saying something yourself."
Gergi shook his head, looked out at the traffic on the boulevard. "If people want to lie about me, that's a matter for their consciences. At least I don't have to talk to them. I really could not care less what they say." Peckwill looked at Gergi with an expression of astonishment, but said nothing. Fleer Imsaho made a chuckling noise over its constant hum. Gergi talked it over with the ship. The limiting factor said that the game could probably have been won more elegantly, but what Gergi had done did represent one end of the spectrum of unlikely possibilities it had been going to sketch out the previous night. It congratulated him. He had played better than it had thought possible. It also asked him why he hadn't listened after it had told him it could see a way out. "All I wanted to know was that there was a way out." Again the delay, the weight of time while his beamed words lanced beneath the matter-dimpled surface that was real space.
"But I could have helped you," said the ship. "I thought it was a bad sign when you'd refused my aid. I began to think you'd given up in your mind, if not on the board."
"I didn't want help, ship." He played with the orbital bracelet, wondering absently if it portrayed any particular world, and if so, which. "I wanted hope."
"I see," the ship said eventually.
"I wouldn't accept it," the drone said.
"You wouldn't accept what?" Gergi asked, looking up from a hollow displayed board.
"Zar's invitation."
The tiny machine floated closer. It had discarded its bulky disguise now they were back inside the module. Gergi looked coldly at it. "I didn't notice it was addressed to you, too." Shehobham Zar had sent a message congratulating Gergi and inviting him out for an evening's entertainment.
"Well, it wasn't, but I'm supposed to monitor everything."
"Are you really?" Gergi turned back to the hollow spread before him. "Well, you can stay here and monitor whatever you like while I go out on the town with Shehobham Zar tonight."
"You'll regret it," the drone told him. "You've been very sensible staying in and not getting involved, but you'll suffer for it if you do start gallivanting."
"Gallivanting?" Gergi stared at the drone, realizing only then how difficult it was to look something up and down when it was just a few centimeters high. "What are you, drone, my mother?"
"I'm just trying to be sensible about this," the machine said, voice rising. "You're in a strange society. You're not the most worldly wise of people, and Zar certainly isn't my idea of you opinionated box of junk,"
Gergi said loudly, rising and switching off the hollow screen. The drone jumped in midair. It backed off hastily.
"Now, now, Juno Gergi, don't you now me, you patronizing adding machine. If I want to take an evening off, I will. And quite frankly, the thought of some human company for a change is looking more attractive all the time."
He jabbed a finger at the machine. "Don't read any more of my mail, and don't bother about escorting Zar and me this evening." He walked quickly past it, heading for his cabin.
"Now, I'm going to take a shower. Why don't you go watch some birds?"
The man left the module's lounge. The little drone hovered steadily in midair for a while.
"Oops,"
it said to itself, eventually. Then, with a shrug-like wobble, swooped away, fields vaguely rosy.
"Have some of this," Zar said.
The car swept along the city streets beneath the iridescent skies of dusk. Gergi took the flask and drank.
"Not quite Griff," Zar told him, "but it does the job."
He took the flask back while Gergi coughed a little.
"Did you let that Griff get to you at the ball?"
"No," Gergi admitted. "I bypassed it, wanted a clear head."
"Ah, heck," Zar said, looking downcast. "You mean I could have had more?"
He shrugged, brightened, tapped Gergi on the elbow. "Hey,
I never said congratulations on winning the game.
Thanks. That showed him. Wow, did you give them a shock?
Zar shook his head in admiration. His long brown hair swung across his loose tunic top like heavy smoke.
I had you filed as a prime loser, J.G. You're some kind of showman.
He winked one bright green eye at Gergay and grinned. Gergay looked uncertainly at Zar's beaming face for a moment, then burst out laughing. He took the flask from Zar's hand and put it to his lips.
To the showman, he said, and drank. Amen to that, my maestro.
The Player of Games by Ian M. Banks. Read by Peter Kenny.
The Hole had been on the outskirts of the city once, but now it was just another part of one more urban district. The Hole was a set of vast artificial caverns burrowed out of the chalk centuries ago to store natural gas in. The gas had long since run out. The city ran on other forms of energy, and the set of huge linked caves had been colonized. First by Grosnachek's paw, then, by a slow process of osmosis and displacement, as though gas or human nothing ever really changed, by its criminals and outlaws, and finally, though not completely, by its effectively ghettoized aliens and their supporting cast of locals. Gergay and Zar's car drove into what had once been a massive above-ground gas storage cylinder, and it had become the housing for a pair of spiraling ramps taking cars and other vehicles down into and up out of the hole. In the centre of the still mostly empty, ringingly echoing cylinder, a cluster of variously sized lifts slid up and down inside ramshackle frameworks of girders, tubing and beams. The outer and inner surfaces of the ancient gasometer sparkled slatily under rainbow lights and the flickeringly unreal, grotesquely oversized images of advertising hollows. People milled about the surface level of the cavernous tower, and the air was full of shouting, screaming, haggling voices and the sound of laboring engines. Gergay watched the crowds and the stalls and stands slide by as the car dipped and started its long descent. A strange, half-sweet, half-acrid smell seeped through the car's conditioning like a sweaty breath from the place. They quit the car in a long, low, crowded tunnel where the air was heavy with fumes and shouts. The gallery was choked with multifariously shaped and sized vehicles which rumbled and hissed and edged about among the swarmingly varied people, like massive, clumsy animals wading in an insect sea. Zar took Gergay by the hand as their car trundled toward the ascending ramp. They went bustling through the buffeting crowds of Azadians and other humanoids toward a limely glowing tunnel mouth.
"What do you think so far?" Zar shouted back to Gergay. "Crowded, isn't it? You should see it on a holiday."
Gergay looked round at the people. He felt ghost-like, invisible. Until now he'd been the centre of attention, a freak, stared and gawped and peered at, and kept entirely at arm's length.
Now, suddenly, nobody gave a damn, hardly sparing him a second glance.
They bumped into him, jostled him, shoved past him, brushed against him, all quite careless. And so varied, even in this sickly, sea-green tunnel light. So many different types of people mixed in with the Azadians he was becoming used to seeing. A few aliens that looked vaguely familiar from his memory of pan-human types, but mostly quite wildly different. He lost count of the variations in limbs, height, bulk, physiognomy and sensory apparatus he was confronted with during that short walk. They went down the warm tunnel and into a huge, brightly lit cavern, at least 80 meters tall and half as broad again. Lengthwise, its cream-coloured walls stretched away in both directions for half a kilometre or more, ending in great side-lit arches leading to further galleries. Its flat floor was chock-a-block with shack-like buildings and tents, partitions and covered walkways, stalls and kiosks, and small squares with dribbling fountains and gaily striped awnings. Lamps danced from wires strung on thin poles, and overhead brighter lights burned high in the vaulted roof, a colour between ivory and pewter. Structures of stepped buildings and wall or roof-hung gantries lined the sides of the gallery, and whole areas of grimy grey wall were punctured by the irregular holes of windows, balconies, terraces and doors. Lifts and pulleys creaked and rattled, taking people to higher levels or lowering them to the bustling floor.
"This way," Zar said.
They wove their way through the narrow streets of the gallery surface until they came to the far wall, climbed some broad but rickety wooden steps, and approached a heavy wooden door, guarded by a metal portcullis and a pair of lumberingly large figures. One Azadian male and another whose species Gergay couldn't identify. Zar waved, and without either guard appearing to do anything, The portcullis rose. The door swung ponderously open, and he and Tsar left the echoing cave behind for the relative quietness of a dim, wood-lined, heavily carpeted tunnel. The cavern light closed off behind them. A hazy, cerise glow came through an arched ceiling of wafer-thin plaster. The polished wooden walls looked thick, were char-dark, and felt warm. Muffled music came from ahead. Another door. A desk set into an alcove where two apices eyed them both sullenly, then consented to smile at Tsar, who passed over a small hide pouch to them. The door opened. He and Gerge went through to the light and music and noise beyond. It was a jumble of a space, impossible to decide whether it was one confusingly subdivided, chaotically split-levelled hall, or a profusion of smaller rooms and galleries all knocked into one. The place was packed and loud with high-pitched atonal music. It could have been on fire, judging from the thick haze of smoke filling it, but the fumes smelled sweet, almost perfumed. Tsar guided Gerge through crowds to a wooden cupola raised a meter off a small covered walkway, and looking out from the rear onto a sort of staggered stage beneath. The stage was surrounded by similar circular boxes, as well as various stepped areas of seats and benches, all of which were crowded, mostly with Azadians. On the small, roughly circular stage below, some dwarfish alien, only vaguely pan-human, was wrestling, or perhaps copulating, with an Azadian female in a quivering tub full of gently steaming red mud, all seemingly held in a low-G field. The spectators shouted and clapped and threw drinks.
"Oh, good," Tsar said, sitting down. "The fun started."
"Are they fucking or fighting?" Gerge said, leaning over the rail and peering down at the struggling, heaving bodies of the alien and the female. Tsar shrugged.
"Does it matter?"
A waitress, an Azadian female, wearing only a little cloth around her waist, took Tsar's drink order. The woman's puffball hair appeared to be on fire, surrounded by a flickering hologram of yellow-blue flames. Gerge turned away from the stage. The audience behind him yelled appreciatively as the woman threw the alien off and jumped on top of him, throwing him under the steaming mud.
"You come here often?" he asked Tsar.
The tall male laughed loudly.
"No?"
The great green eyes flashed.
"But I leave quite a lot."
"This way you relax."
Tsar shook his head emphatically.
"Absolutely not. Common misconception that fun is relaxing. If it is, you're not doing it right. That's what the hole's for, fun. Fun and games. Cools down a bit during the day, but it can get pretty wild, too. The drink festivals are usually the worst. Shouldn't be any trouble tonight, though. Fairly quiet."
The crowd shrieked. The woman was holding the dwarfish alien's face under the mud. It struggled desperately. Gerge turned round to watch. The alien's movements weakened slowly as the naked, mud-slicked woman forced its head into the bubbling red liquid. Gerge glanced at Tsar. So they were fighting. Tsar shrugged again.
"We may never know."
He looked down too, as the woman forced the now limp alien's body further into the ochre mud.
"Has she killed it?"
Gerge asked. He had to raise his voice as the crowd screamed, stamping feet and beating fists on tables.
"Nah," Shohobam Tsar said, shaking his head.
"The little guy is a nyerkel."
Tsar nodded down as the woman used one hand to keep the alien's head submerged and raised the other in triumph in the air, glaring bright-eyed at the baying audience.
"See that little black thing sticking up?"
Gerge looked. There was a little black bulb poking up through the surface of the red mud.
"Yes,
that's his dick."
Gerge looked suspiciously at the other man.
"How exactly is that going to help him?"
"The Anurkel can breathe through their dicks," Tsar said. "That guy's fine. He'll be fighting in another club tomorrow night, maybe even later this evening."
Tsar watched the waitress place their drinks on the table. He leaned forward to whisper something to her. She nodded and walked off.
"Try glanding expand with this stuff," Tsar suggested.
Gerge nodded. They both drank.
"Wonder why the cultures never genifixed that," Tsar said, staring into his glass.
"What?"
"Being able to breathe through your dick."
Gerge thought.
"Sneezing at certain moments could be messy."
Tsar laughed.
"There might be compensations."
The audience behind them went, "Ooh." Tsar and Gerge turned round to see the victorious woman pulling her opponent's body up out of the mud by its penis. The alien being's head and feet were still under the glutinous, slowly slopping liquid.
Ouch! Za muttered, drinking. Somebody in the crowd tossed the woman a dagger. She caught it, stooped, and sliced off the alien genitals. She brandished the dripping flesh aloft while the crowd went wild with delight, and the alien sank slowly beneath the cloying red liquid, the woman's foot on its chest. The mud gradually turned black where the blood oozed and a few bubbles surfaced. Zar sat back, looking mystified.
Must have been some subspecies I haven't heard of.
The low-G mud tub was trundled away, the woman still shaking her trophy at the baying crowd. Shehobaham Zar rose to meet a party of four dramatically beautiful and stunningly dressed Azadian females who were approaching the cupola. Gergay had glanded the body drug Zar had suggested and was just beginning to feel the effects of both that and the liquor. The women looked, he thought, quite the equals of any he'd seen the night of the welcoming ball, and much more friendly. The acts went on, sex acts mostly. Acts which outside the hole, Gergay was told by Zar and two of the Azadian females, Inklate and Atsen, sitting on either side of him, would mean death for both participants, death by radiation or death by chemicals. Gergay didn't pay too much attention. This was his night out, and the staged obscenities were the least important part of it. He was away from the game. That was what mattered. Living by another set of rules. He knew why Zar had had the women come to the table, and it amused him. He felt no particular desire for the two exquisite creatures he sat between. Certainly nothing uncontrollable, but they made good company. Zar was no fool, and the two charming females, Gergay knew they would have been males or even apices had Zar discovered Gergay's preferences lay in that direction, were both intelligent and witty. They knew a little about the culture, had heard rumours about the sexual alterations culture people possessed, and made discreetly roguish jokes about Gergay's proclivities and abilities compared to their own, and to both the other Azadian genders. They were flattering, enticing and friendly. They drank from small glasses, they sipped smoke from tiny, slender pipes. Gergay had tried a pipe too, but only coughed, much to everyone's amusement. And they both had long, sinuously curling blue-black hair, silkily membraned with near invisibly fine platinum nets, and beaded with minute, glinting AG studs, which made their hair move in slow motion and gave each graceful movement of their delicately structured heads a dizzyingly unreal quality. Inklate's slim dress was the ever-shifting colour of oil on water, speckled with jewels which twinkled like stars. Atsen's was a video dress, glowing fuzzy red with its own concealed power. A choker round her neck acted as a small television monitor, displaying a hazy, distorted image of the view around her. Gergay to one side, the stage behind, one of Zar's ladies on the other side, the other directly across the table. Gergay showed her the orbital bracelet, but she was not especially impressed. Zar, on the other side of the table, was playing small games of forfeit with his two giggling ladies, handling tiny, almost transparent, sliced jewel cards, and laughing a lot. One of the ladies noted the forfeits down in a little notebook, with much giggling and feigned embarrassment.
"But Jernau," Atsen said from Gergay's left, "you must have a scar portrait, so that we may remember you when you have gone back to the culture and its decadent many orificed ladies."
Inklate, on his right, giggled.
"Certainly not," Gergay said, mock-serious. "It sounds quite barbaric."
"Oh, yes, yes, it is."
Atsen and Inklate laughed into their glasses. Atsen pulled herself together, put her hand on his wrist.
"Wouldn't you like to think there was some poor person walking around on Ea with your face on their skin?"
"Yes, but on which bit?" Gergay asked. They thought this hilariously funny.
Zar stood. One of his ladies packed the tiny slivers of the game cards away in a little chain purse.
"Gergay," Zar said, knocking back the last of his drink. "We're off for a more private chat. You three too?"
Zar grinned wickedly at Inklate and Atsen, producing gales of laughter and small shrieks. Atsen dipped her fingers in her drink and flicked some liquor at Zar, who dodged.
"Yes, come, Jernau,"
Inklate said, taking hold of Gergay's arm with both hands.
"Let's all go. The air is so stuffy here, and the noise so loud."
Gergay smiled, shook his head.
"No, I only disappoint you."
"Oh, no, no."
Slim fingers tugged at his sleeves, curled round his arms. The politely mocking argument went on for some minutes, while Zar stood grinning, ladies draped on either side looking on,
and Inklate and Atsen tried their hardest either to physically lift Gurge to his feet or, by pouting protestations, persuade him to move. All failed. Zar shrugged. His ladies imitated the alien gesture before dissolving into laughter and said, "Okay, just stay there, all right, game player?" Zar looked at Inklate and Atsen, who were temporarily subdued and petulant. "You two look after him, right?" Zar told them. "Don't let him talk to any strangers." Atsen sniffed imperiously.
"Your friend declines all, strange or familiar."
Inklate snorted despite herself.
"Or both in one,"
she blurted. Whereupon, she and Atsen started laughing again and reaching behind Gurge to slap and pinch each other's shoulders. Zar shook his head.
"Jernau, try and control those two as well as you control yourself."
Gurge ducked a few flicked drops of drink while the female squealed on either side of him.
"I'll try," he told Zar.
"Well," Zar said, "I'll try not to be too long. Sure you won't join in? Could be quite an experience."
"I'm sure, but I'm fine here."
"Okay, don't wander. See you soon."
Zar grinned at the giggling girls on either side of him, and then they turned together, walked away.
"Ish," Zar shouted back over his shoulder. "Soon-ish, game player."
Gurge waved goodbye. Inklate and Atsen quietened fractionally and set about telling him what a naughty boy he was for not being more naughty. Gurge ordered more drinks and pipes to keep them quiet. They showed him how to play the game of elements, chanting, "Blade cuts cloth, cloth wraps stone, stone dams water, water quenches fire, fire melts blade," like serious schoolgirls, and showing him the appropriate hand shapes so that he could learn. It was a truncated, two-dimensional version of the elemental die-matching from the Board of Becoming, minus air and life. Gurge found it amusing that even in the hole he could not escape the influence of Azad. He played the simple game because the ladies wanted to, and he took care not to win too many hands, something, he realized, he'd never done before in his life. Still puzzling over this anomaly, he went to the toilets, of which there were four different types. He used the aliens, but took some time to find the right piece of equipment. He was still chortling over this when he came out, to find Inklate standing outside the sphincter-like doorway. She looked worried. The oil-film dress rippled dully. "What's wrong?" he asked her.
"Atsen," she said, kneading her little hands together. "Her ex-master came, took her away. He wants to have her again, or it will be a 10th year since they are one, and she will be free."
She looked up at Gurge, small face contorted, distressed. The blue-black hair washed round her face like a slow and liquid shadow.
"I know Shoza said you must not move, but will you? This is not your concern, but she's my friend."
"What can I do?" Gurge said.
"Come, we two may distract him. I think I know why he's taken her. I shall not endanger you, Jernau."
She took his hand. They half walked, half ran down twisting wooden corridors, past many rooms and doors. He was lost in a maze of sensation, a welter of sounds, music, laughter, screams, sights, servants, erotic pictures, glimpsed galleries of packed, swaying bodies, and smells, food, perfume, alien sweats. Suddenly, Inklate stopped. They were in a deep, bold room, like a theatre, where a naked human male stood on stage, turning slowly, this way and that, in front of a giant screen, showing a close-up of his skin. Deep, booming music played. Inklate stood looking round the packed auditorium, still holding Gurge's hand. Gurge glanced at the man on stage. The lights were bright, sunlight spectred. The slightly plump, pale-skinned male had several enormous, multicoloured bruises, like huge prints on his body. Those on his back and chest were largest and showed Azadian faces. The mixture of blacks, blues, purples, greens, yellows and reds combined to form portraits of uncanny accuracy and subtlety, which the flexings of the man's muscles seemed to make live, exactly as though those faces took on new expressions with each moment. Gurge looked and felt his breath draw in.
"There!"
Inklate shouted over the pulsing music and tugged at his hand. They set off through the crowding people toward where Atsen stood near the front of the stage. She was being held by an apex who was pointing at the man on the stage and shouting at her, shaking her. Atsen's head was down, her shoulders quivered as if she was crying. The video dress was turned off. It hung on her, grey and drab and lifeless. The apex hit Atsen across the head. The slow black hair twisted languidly and shouted at her again. She fell to her knees. The beaded hair followed her as if she was sinking slowly underwater. Nobody around the couple took any notice. Inklate strode toward them, pulling Gergay after her. The Apex saw them coming, tried to drag Atsen away. Inklate started to shout at the Apex. She held up Gergay's hand as they pushed people aside and drew closer. The Apex looked suddenly fearful. He stumbled away, dragging Atsen with him to an exit beneath the raised stage. Inklate started forward, but her way was blocked by a cluster of large Azadian males, standing, staring open-mouthed at the man on the stage. Inklate beat at their backs with her fists. Gergay watched Atsen disappear, dragged through the door beneath the stage. He pulled Inklate to one side and used his greater mass and strength to force a way between two of the protesting males. He and the girl ran to the swinging door. The corridor curved sharply. They followed the sounds of screams, down some narrow stairs, over a step where the broken monitor collar lay snapped and dead, down to a quiet corridor where the light was jade and there were many doors. Atsen was lying on the floor, the Apex above her screaming at her. He saw Gergay and Inklate, shook his fist at them. Inklate screamed incoherently at him. Gergay started forward. The Apex took a gun from a pocket. Gergay stopped. Inklate went quiet. Atsen whimpered on the floor. The Apex started talking, far too fast for Gergay to follow. He pointed at the woman on the floor, then gestured at the ceiling. He began to cry, and the gun shook in his hand, and part of Gergay, sitting back calmly, analyzing, thought, "Am I frightened? Is this fear yet? I'm looking death in the face, staring at it through that little black hole, the little twisted tunnel in this alien's hand, like another element the hand can show, and I'm waiting to feel fear. And it hasn't happened yet. I'm still waiting. Does this mean that I shan't die now, or that I shall? Life or death in a finger's twitch, a single nerve pulse, just one, perhaps not fully willed decision by some jealous, irrelevant, one-credit sickhead, 100 millennia from home." The Apex backed away, gesturing imploringly, pathetically to Atsen and at Gergay and Inklate. He came forward and kicked Atsen once in the back with no great force, making her cry out, then turned and ran, shouting incoherently and throwing the gun down to the floor. Gergay ran after him, vaulting over Atsen. The Apex disappeared down a dark spiral staircase at the far end of the curved passage. Gergay started to follow, then stopped. The sound of clattering footsteps died away. He went back to the jade-lit corridor. A door was open. Soft citrine light spilled out. There was a short hall, a bathroom off, then the room. It was small and mirrored everywhere, even the soft floor rippled with unsteady reflections the color of honey. He walked in at the center of a vanishing army of reflected Gergays. Atsen sat on a translucent bed, forlorn in her wrecked gray dress, head down and sobbing, while Inklate, kneeling by her, arm round the crying woman's shoulders, whispered gently. Their images proliferated about the shining walls of the room. He hesitated, glanced back at the door. Atsen looked up at him, tears streaming.
"Oh, Jernal!"
She held out one shaking hand. He squatted by the bedside, his arm round her as she quivered, while both women cried. He stroked Atsen's back. She put her head on his shoulder, and her lips were warm and strange on his neck. Inklate left the bed, padded to the door and closed it, then joined the man and the woman, dropping the oil-film dress to the mirror floor in a glistening pool of iridescence. Shehobaham Zah arrived a minute later, kicking the door in, walking smartly into the middle of the mirrored room so that an infinitude of Zahs repeated and repeated their way across that cheating space, and glared round, ignoring the three people on the bed. Inklate and Atsen froze, hands at Gergay's clothing ties and buttons. Gergay was momentarily shocked, then tried to assume an urbane expression. Zah looked at the wall behind Gergay, who followed his gaze. He found himself looking at his own reflection, face dark, hair mussed, clothes half undone. Zah leapt across the bed, kicking into the image. The wall shattered in a chorus of screams. The mirror glass cascaded to reveal a dark and shallow room behind, and a small machine on a tripod pointing into the mirror room. Inklate and Atsen sprang off the bed and raced out. Inklate grabbed her dress on the way. Zah took the tiny camera off its tripod and looked at it. "Record only, thank goodness, no transmitter." He stuffed the machine into a pocket, then turned and grinned at Gergay. "Put it back in the holster, game player, we gotta run." They ran. Down the jade passage toward the same spiral steps Atsin's abductor had taken. Zar stooped as he ran, scooping up the gun the apex had dropped and Gurge had forgotten about. It was inspected, tried and discarded within a couple of seconds. They got to the spiral steps and leapt up them. Another corridor, darkly russet. Music boomed above. Zar skidded to a stop as two large apices ran toward them.
Oops, Zar said, doing an about-turn.
He shoved Gurge back to the stairs and they ran up again, coming out in a dark space full of the beating, pulsing music. Light blazed to one side. Footsteps hammered up the stairs. Zar turned and kicked down into the stairwell with one foot, producing an explosive yelp at a sudden clatter. A thin, blue beam freckled the darkness, lancing from the stairwell and bursting yellow flame and orange sparks somewhere overhead. Zar dodged away.
Fucking artillery, indeed.
He nodded past Gurge toward the light.
Exit stage center, maestro.
They ran out onto the stage, flooded with sunlight brilliance. A bulky male in the center of the stage turned resentfully as they thundered out from the wings. The audience yelled abuse. Then the expression on the near-naked bruise artiste's face switched from vexation to stunned surprise. Gurge almost fell. He did stop, dead still, to gaze again at his own face. It was printed, twice life-size, in a bloody rainbow of contusions on the torso of the dumbstruck performer. Gurge stared, expression mirroring the amazement on the tubby artiste's face.
No time for art now, Jernau.
Zar pulled him away, dragged him to the front of the stage and threw him off. He dived after him. They landed on top of a group of protesting Azadian males, tumbling them to the ground. Zar hauled Gurge to his feet, then nearly fell again as a blow struck the back of his head. He turned and lashed out with one foot, fending off another punch with one arm. Gurge felt himself twirled round. He found himself facing a large, angry male with blood on his face. The man drew his arm back, made a fist of his hand, so that Gurge thought stone from the Game of Elements. The man seemed to move very slowly. Gurge had time to think what to do. He brought his knee up into the male's groin and heel-palmed his face. He shook the falling man's grip free, ducked a blow from another male, and saw Zar elbow yet another Azadian in the face. Then they were sprinting away again. Zar roared and waved his hands as he ran for an exit. Gurge fought a strange urge to laugh at this, but the tactic seemed to work. People parted for them like water round the bows of a boat. They sat in a small open-ceilinged bar, deep in the maze-like clutter of the main gallery, under a solid sky of chalky pearl. Shehobaham Zar was dismantling the camera he'd discovered behind the false mirror, teasing its delicate components apart with a humming toothpick-sized instrument. Gurge dabbed at a graze on his cheek, incurred when Zar had thrown him from the stage.
Nah, my fault, game player. I should have known. Inklink's brothers in security and Atsen's got an expensive habit. Nice kids, but a bad combination, and not exactly what I asked for. Damn lucky for your ass, one of my sweeties dropped a slice jewel card and wouldn't play anything else without it. Ah, well, half a fuck's better than none at all.
He prized another piece out of the camera body. There was a crackle and a little flash. Zar poked dubiously at the smoking casing.
How did you know where to find us? Gurge asked.
He felt like a fool, but less embarrassed than he'd have expected.
Knowledge, guesswork, and luck, game player. There are places in that club you go when you want to roll somebody. Other places where you can question them, or kill them, or hook them on something. Or take their picture. I was just hoping it was lights action time and not something worse.
He shook his head, peered at the camera.
I should have known, though. Ought to have guessed. Getting too damn trusting.
Gurge shrugged, sipped at his hot liquor, and studied the guttering candle on the counter in front of them. I was the one who was suckered. But who? He looked at Zar.
Why? The state, Gurge, Zar said, prodding at the camera again. Because they want to have something on you, just in case.
Just in case what?
Just in case you keep surprising them and winning games. It's insurance. You heard of that? No? Never mind. It's like gambling in reverse.
Zar held the camera with one hand, straining at part of it with a thin instrument. A hatch popped open. Zar looked happy and extricated a coin-sized disc from the guts of the machine. He held it up to the light, where it glinted nacreously.
Your holiday snaps, Zar told Gurge.
He adjusted something at the end of the toothpick, so that the little disc stuck to the instrument's point as though glued there. then held the tiny polychromatic coin over the candle flame until it sizzled and smoked and hissed, and finally fell in dull flakes onto the wax.
"Sorry you couldn't have had that as a souvenir," Za said.
Gurge shook his head.
"Something I'd rather forget." "Ah, never mind. I'll get those two bitches, though," Za grinned. "They owe me one for free. Several, in fact."
Za looked happy at the thought.
"Is that all?" Gurge asked. "Hey, they were just playing their parts. No malice involved. Worth a spanking at most."
Za waggled his eyebrows lasciviously. Gurge sighed. When they went back to the transit gallery to order their car, Za waved at some bulky, severely casual males and apices waiting in the lime-lit tunnel and tossed one of them what was left of the camera. The apex caught it and turned away along with the others. The car arrived minutes later.
"And what time do you call this? Do you know how long I've been waiting for you? You've got a game to play tomorrow, you know. Just look at the state of your clothes. And where did you pick up that graze? What have you been—"
"Machine," Gurge yawned, throwing his jacket down onto a seat in the lounge. "Go fuck yourself." The following morning, Fleer Imsaho wasn't talking to him. It joined him in the module lounge, just as the call came through that Pequil had arrived with the car. But when Gurge said hello, it ignored him, and travelled down in the hotel elevator, studiously humming and crackling even louder than usual. It was similarly uncommunicative in the car. Gurge decided he could live with this.
"Gurge, you have hurt yourself."
Pequil looked with concern at the graze over Gurge's cheek. "Yes," Gurge smiled, stroking his beard. "I cut myself shaving." It was attrition time on the board of form. Gurge was up against the other 9 players from the start, until it became too obvious that that was happening. He'd used the advantage accrued on the previous board to set up a small, dense, and almost impregnable enclave. He just sat in there for 2 days, letting the other players beat up against it. Done properly, this would have broken him, but his opponents were trying not to look too concerted in their actions, so attacked a few at a time. They were anyway each fearful of weakening themselves overmuch in case they were pounced upon by the others. By the end of those 2 days, a couple of the news agencies were saying it was unfair and discourteous to the stranger to gang up on him. Fleer Imsaho, over its huff by then and talking to him again, reckoned this reaction might be genuine and unprompted, but was more likely to be the result of imperial pressure. Certainly it thought the church, which had doubtless been instructing the priest as well as financing the deals he'd been making with the other players, had been leaned on by the imperial office. Whatever, on the 3rd day, the massed attacks against Gurge fell away, and the game resumed a more normal course. The game hall was crowded with people. There were many more paying spectators. Numerous invited guests had changed venue to come and see the alien play, and the press agencies had sent extra reporters and cameras. The club players, under the stewardship of the adjudicator, succeeded in keeping the crowd quiet, so Gurge didn't find the extra people caused any great distraction during the game. It was difficult to move around the hall during the breaks, though. People were constantly accosting him, asking him questions, or just wanting to look at him. Pequil was there most of the time, but seemed more taken up with going in front of the cameras himself than shielding Gurge from all the people wanting to talk to him. At least he helped to divert the attentions of the news people and let Gurge concentrate on the game. Over the next couple of days, Gurge noticed a subtle change in the way the priest was playing, and, to a lesser degree, in the game style of another 2 players. Gurge had taken 3 players right out of the game. Another 3 had been taken by the priest, without much of a fight. The remaining 2 APCs had established their own small enclaves on the board, and were taking comparatively little part in the wider game. Gurge was playing well, if not at quite the pitch he had when he'd won on the board of origin. He ought to be defeating the priest and the other 2 fairly easily. He was, indeed, gradually prevailing, but very slowly. The priest was playing better than he had before, especially at the beginning of each session, which made Gurge think that the apex was getting some high-grade help during the breaks. The same applied to the other 2 players, though they were presumably being less extensively briefed. When the end came, though, on the 5th day of the game, it was sudden, and the priest's play simply collapsed. The other 2 players resigned. More adulation followed, and the news agencies began to run editorials worrying that somebody from outside could do so well. Some of the more sensational releases even carried stories that the alien from the culture was using some sort of supernatural sense or illegal technical device. They'd found out Fleer Imsaho's name and mentioned it as the possible source of Gurge's illicit skill.
They're calling me a computer,
the drone wailed. And they're calling me a cheat, Gerge said thoughtfully. Life is cruel, as they keep saying here.
Here, they are correct.
The last game on the board of becoming, the one Gerge felt most at home on, was a romp. The priest had filed a special objective plan with the adjudicator before the game commenced, something he was entitled to do as the player with the second largest number of points. He was effectively playing for second place. Although he would be out of the main series, he would have a chance to re-enter it if he won his next two games in the second series. Gerge suspected this was a ruse, and played very cautiously at first, waiting for either the mass attack or some cunning individual set piece. But the others seemed to be playing almost aimlessly, and even the priest seemed to be making the sort of slightly mechanical moves he'd been making in the first game. When Gerge made a few light, exploratory attacks, he found little opposition. He divided his forces in half and went on a full-scale raid into the territory of the priest just for the sheer hell of it. The priest panicked and hardly made one good move after that. By the end of the session, he was in danger of being wiped out. After the break, Gerge was attacked by all the others while the priest struggled, pinned against one edge of the board. Gerge took the hint. He gave the priest room to maneuver and let him attack two of the weaker players to regain his position on the board. The game finished with Gerge established over most of the board and the others either eradicated or confined to small, strategically irrelevant areas. Gerge had no particular interest in fighting the game out to the bitter end, and anyway guessed that if he tried to do so, the others would form a united opposition, no matter how obvious it was they were working together. Gerge was being offered victory, but he would suffer if he tried to be greedy or vindictive. The status quo was agreed. The game ended. The priest came second on points. Just. Pequill congratulated him again outside the hall. He'd reached the second round of the main series. He was one of only 1,200 first winners, and twice that number of qualifiers. He would now play against one person in the second round. Again, the Apex begged Gerge to give a news conference, and again, Gerge refused.
But you must! What are you trying to do? If you don't say something soon, you'll turn them against you. This enigmatic stuff won't do forever, you know. You're the underdog at the moment. Don't lose that.
Pequill, Gerge said, fully aware he was insulting the Apex by addressing him so. I have no intention of speaking to anybody about my game, and what they choose to say or think about me is irrelevant. I am here to play the game and nothing else.
You are our guest, Pequill said coldly,
and you are my hosts. Gerge turned and walked away from the official, and the ride back in the car was completed in silence, save for Fleer Imsaho's humming, which occasionally sounded to Gerge as if it barely concealed a chuckling laugh.
Now the trouble starts.
Why do you say that, Ship? It was night. The rear doors of the module lay open. Gerge could hear the distant buzz of the police hoverplane stationed over the hotel to keep news agency craft away. The smell of the city, warm and spicy and smoky, drifted in too. Gerge was studying a set-piece problem in a single game and taking notes. This seemed to be the best way of talking to the limited factor with a time delay. Talk, then switch off and consider the problem while the HS light flashed to and fro. Then, when the reply came, switch back to speech mode. It was almost like having a real conversation.
Because now you have to show your moral cards. It's the single match, so you have to define your first principles, register your philosophical premises. Therefore, you will have to give them some of the things you believe in. I believe this could prove troublesome.
Ship, Gerge said, writing some notes on a scratch tablet as he studied the hollow in front of him. I'm not sure I have any beliefs.
I think you do, Jerno Gerge, and the Imperial Game Bureau will want to know what they are, for the record. I'm afraid you'll have to think of something.
Why should I? What does it matter? I can't win any posts or ranks. I'm not going to gain any power out of this, so what difference does it make what I believe in? I know they need to find out what people in power think, but I just want to play the game.
Yes, but they will need to know for their statistics. Your views may not matter a jot in terms of the elective properties of the game, but they do need to keep a record of what sort of player wins what sort of match. Besides which, they will be interested in what sort of extremist politics you give credence to.
Gerge looked at the screen camera. Extremist politics? What are you talking about?
Jerno Gerge, the machine said, making a sighing noise. A guilty system recognizes no innocence, As with any power apparatus, which thinks everybody's either for it or against it, we're against it. You would be too, if you thought about it. The very way you think places you among its enemies. This might not be your fault, because every society imposes some of its values on those raised within it. But the point is that some societies try to maximize that effect, and some try to minimize it. You come from one of the latter, and you're being asked to explain yourself to one of the former. Prevarication will be more difficult than you might imagine. Neutrality is probably impossible. You cannot choose not to have the politics you do. They are not some separate set of entities, somehow detachable from the rest of your being. They are a function of your existence. I know that, and they know that. You had better accept it.
Gergay thought about this.
Can I lie? I shall take it you mean, would you be advised to register false premises, rather than are you capable of telling untruths?
Gergay shook his head.
This would probably be the wisest course, though you may find it difficult to come up with something acceptable to them, which you didn't find morally repugnant yourself.
Gergay looked back to the hollow display. Oh, you'd be surprised, he muttered. Anyway, if I'm lying about it, how can I find it repugnant?
An interesting point, if one assumes that one is not morally opposed to lying in the first place, especially when it is largely, or significantly, what we term self-interested, rather than disinterested or compassionate lying, then...
Gergay stopped listening and studied the hollow. He really must look at some of his opponent's previous games, once he knew who it would be. He heard the ship stop talking. Tell you what, ship, he said. Why don't you think about it? You seem more engrossed in the whole idea than I do, and I'm busy enough anyway, so why don't you work out a compromise between truth and expediency we'll all be happy with, hm? I'll agree to whatever you suggest, probably.
Very well, Jerno Gergay. I'll be happy to do that.
Gergay bade the ship good night. He completed his study of the single game problem, then switched the screen off. He stood and stretched, yawning. He strolled out of the module into the orange-brown darkness of the hotel roof garden. He almost bumped into a large, uniformed male. The guard saluted, a gesture Gergay never did know how to reply to, and handed him a piece of paper. Gergay took it and thanked him. The guard went back to his station at the top of the roof stairs. Gergay walked back into the module, trying to read the note. "Fleer Imsaho," he called, uncertain whether the little machine was still around or not. It came floating through from another part of the module in its undisguised quiet form, carrying a large, richly illustrated book on the avian fauna of Ear.
"Yes?"
"What does this say?" Gergay flourished the note. The drone floated up to the piece of paper.
"Minus the imperial embroidery, it says they'd like you to go to the palace tomorrow, so they can add their congratulations. What it means is, they want to take a look at you."
"I suppose I have to go."
"I would say so."
"Does it mention you?"
"No, but I'll come along anyway. They can only throw me out. What were you talking to the ship about?"
"It's going to register my premises for me. It was also giving me a lecture on sociological conditioning."
"It means well," said the drone. "It just doesn't want to leave such a delicate task to someone like you."
"Just going out, were you, drone?" Gergay said, switching on the screen again and sitting down to watch it. He brought up the game player's channel on the Imperial waveband and flicked through to the draw for the single matches in the second round. Still no decision. The draw was still being decided, expected any minute.
"Well," Fleer Imsaho said, "there is a very interesting species of nocturnal fish hunter that inhabits an estuary just 100 kilometers from here, and I was thinking..."
"Don't let me keep you," Gergay said, just as the draw started to come through on the Imperial game channel. The screen started to fill with numbers and names.
"Right. I'll say good night then."
The drone floated away. Gergay waved without looking round. "Good night," he said. He didn't hear whether the drone replied or not. He found his place in the draw. His name appeared on the screen beside that of Lo Wishekibold Ram, governing director of the Imperial Monopolies Board. He was ranked as Level 5 main, which meant he was one of the 60 best game players in the Empire. The following day was Pequil's day off. An Imperial aircraft was sent for Gergay and landed beside the module. Gergay and Fleer Imsaho, which had been rather late returning from its estuarial expedition, were taken out of the city to the palace. They landed on the roof of an impressive set of office buildings overlooking one of the small parks set within the palace grounds, and were led down wide, richly carpeted stairs to a high-ceilinged office where a male servant asked Gergay if he wanted anything to eat or drink. Gergay said no, and he and the drone were left alone. Fleer Imsaho drifted over to the tall windows. Gergay looked at some portrait paintings hanging on the walls. After a short while, a youngish apex entered the room. He was tall, dressed in a relatively unfussy and businesslike version of the uniform of the imperial bureaucracy.
"Mr. Gergay, good day. I'm Lo Shav Olos."
"Hello," Gergay said.
They exchanged polite nods. Then the apex walked quickly to a large desk in front of the windows and set a bulky sheaf of papers down on it before sitting down. Lo Shav Olos looked round at Fleer Imsaho, buzzing and hissing away nearby.
"And this must be your little machine?"
"Its name is Fleer Imsaho. It helps me with your language."
"Of course."
The apex gestured to an ornate seat on the other side of the desk.
"Please, sit down."
Gergay sat, and Fleer Imsaho came to float near him. The male servant returned with a crystal goblet and placed it on the desk near Olos, who drank before saying,
"Not that you must need much help, Mr. Gergay."
The young apex smiled. "Your iachik is very good." "Thank you."
"Let me add my personal congratulations to those of the Imperial Office, Mr. Gergay. You have done far better than many of us expected you to do. I understand you are learning the game only for about a third of one of our great years."
"Yes, but I found Azad so interesting I did little else during that time, and it does share concepts with other games I've studied in the past."